Hey everyone, this is Devin Springer, the host here at the Groundings Podcast, and we're here today to record a very sort of special and exciting interview, and to do this episode that I was very quick to hop on board to do once Jeanette from VenezuelaAnalysis.com reached out to me. As you all are probably aware, there's currently a massive global imperialist aggression on Venezuela taking place, and we are here today to get to the bottom of it, to get some sort of historical insight. And then we're going to speak with a few different people from different angles and backgrounds who can sort of put the imperialist to shame. But before I continue with my interview with Jeanette, I'm going to let her introduce herself. So, Jeanette.
Hi, thank you so much for agreeing to work on this collaboration. We're so excited at Venezuela Analysis, and I listen to your program regularly, so it's also just an honor, following the legacy of Walter Rodney and so many Black and African revolutionaries. So just thank you first and foremost for the opportunity to share with folks a little bit about what's happening in Venezuela. To give some background about myself and our work at Venezuela Analysis, Venezuela Analysis is an online multimedia platform that puts out regular analysis and news from the Venezuelan people, from the grassroots, from a left orientation. And we've been doing this work since 2003. Also in light of the 2002 coup attempt, our work emerged kind of in response to the media blockade from corporate media, especially in English. So 15, 16 years later, our work still resonates and still is very relevant. And my work at Venezuela Analysis is as the international solidarity liaison, meaning that I am here to articulate with different movements around the world and to make our work at Venezuela Analysis something that informs, connects, and builds with people beyond just the articles and the analysis, but makes things relevant. Also, in addition to that, we host international solidarity delegations, webinars and teach-ins, and other types of events to just inform people about the revolutionary process that's coming out of Venezuela from the grassroots, from the communes, from the Afro-Venezuelans, from women, from indigenous nations, and what Bolivarian socialism actually means. And then I'm currently based in Los Angeles, and I travel regularly to Venezuela, lived and worked there, doing work with the African diaspora, Haitian populations, Afro-Venezuelans, the histories of Marronage or Cumbes and Palenques in Venezuela. And in addition to this, I identify as a daughter of the Haitian diaspora and have done a lot of work looking at the parallels historically, politically, and economically across Haiti and Venezuela since times of independence up until the present.
So with that and with our introduction, I know we're going to keep this interview relatively brief. I mean, this conversation can go on for several hours, but you have the daunting task of attempting to inform our viewers of lots of historical context and background in really just a few minutes to an hour. What we know right now is that Western media, as you said, particularly English media, and virtually all corporate media have railed against Maduro, the revolution in Venezuela. The whole country of Venezuela is essentially a target right now for regime change. There's even a coup being supported actively. Can you tell us sort of a little bit how we got to this point and what are the significant historical events and incidents that led to this and why... I hate to say why it matters, you know what I mean? But I guess why people should be paying attention, especially people interested in politics in Latin America.
Well, I want to start with that piece. The stakes are really high. Venezuela is at the forefront of an international process that really is trying to shift global power. Venezuela has been doing this work in coalition with countries and nations all around the world, not just Latin America and the Caribbean, though heavily in Latin America and the Caribbean, with African and indigenous majority nations, to displace the United States as the global center of power. And that means not just politically and militarily, but economically. And we're seeing kind of the one of the many battles in that history, in that historical fight right now, in that historical struggle. So I think for anyone who's listening who does work as an organizer, as an activist on the left, who is generally not just concerned about Venezuela, but concerned about the future of humanity, we need to be on the right side of history in regard to what is happening in Venezuela. We need to denounce this U.S.-backed coup attempt for what it is, which is imperialist aggression. And really what it represents is that the forces, you know, that are in favor of humanity, that are in favor of people's power, that are in favor of, you know, an internationalist, you know, working class that has ownership over not just our means of production, but our bodies, our spirits, and, you know, is in living in harmony with the land, we're actually winning, which is why, you know, empire is in the place and the position that it is right now, trying to topple a democratically elected president and invade a sovereign nation. So that's some of the stakes that I think really we need to understand and highlight throughout this program. So essentially, you know, the last couple of weeks represents kind of the culmination of many years of U.S.-backed aggression against Venezuela. We've seen, you know, the 2002 coup. We've seen different waves of right-wing opposition violence through the Guarimbas. We've seen attempts by the political opposition to delegitimate the political and constitutional processes happening in Venezuela. And really since January 23rd, we've seen that in a faster pace. So January 23rd was a day, or is a day, of kind of national commemorative holiday that really looks at the people's overthrow of the U.S.-backed dictator Marcos Perez Jimenez in 1958. And so it's a very emblematic day of popular struggle. And in Venezuela on January 23rd, there are always mass mobilizations in honor of this historical moment that really shifted, you know, some of the political discourse and context in Venezuela at the time. And this is, you know, over 61 years ago. So this January 23rd, there were Chavista mobilizations and there were also right-wing opposition mobilizations. And what's important, I think, to highlight is that the right-wing opposition in Venezuela continuously tries to appropriate and co-opt these really working-class, Black and Indigenous, feminist, youth-led moments for their own under this emblem of democracy, you know, sponsored by the U.S. State Department. And so on January 23rd, Juan Guaido, who is the now head of the National Assembly, which is in a state of contempt because it's in violation of the Constitution. Therefore, a lot of the majority of the accusations that the National Assembly is making that Nicolas Maduro's presidential election and recent inauguration are unconstitutional are invalid. If anything, Juan Guaido and the opposition that is claiming that Juan Guaido is a legitimate interim president is what is unconstitutional. And recently at Venezuela Analysis, we just published an editorial statement that outlines all the different articles that the opposition has attempted to reclaim and say that support Juan Guaido's interim presidency, but do not, such as articles, let me look here, articles 233. And in addition, there is a law that this, I'll just stop at 233, I'm sorry. So Article 233 of the Constitution specifies that an absolute vacuum of power occurs only in the following circumstances: the president's death, a resignation, impeachment, physical or mental incapacity, and abandonment of post, which has not happened or occurred in any moment. The last time that this took place was when President Chavez died in 2013. And in the moments that a president is no longer able to exercise their executive duties, if it occurs within the first 2 years, there's an automatic election that goes into effect. And this is not the circumstances. President Nicolas Maduro was democratically elected in May 2018 with 67% of the vote. That was constitutionally established. It was internationally observed. At Venezuela Analysis, we had a delegation that accompanied the elections in 2018. In addition to that, the claim that President Maduro has abandoned his post is inaccurate. So he is currently exercising all of his duties as president, engaging in all of the diplomatic and other presidential exercises. And so, as we can see, like, there's a huge misinformation campaign that the right wing and the opposition are trying to perpetuate that just does not exist. But this is a long legacy of that. Since 1998, when President Chavez was elected, we've seen the onslaught of media lies and misinformation. And I want to mention, you know, because the 2002 coup is something that resonates so heavily with this particular moment, you know, a lot of the people who are involved in the current opposition, you know, were active politically in 2002. Not necessarily Juan Guaido, who was a child at the time, but for example, I'm just going to recap a little bit what happened in 2002 when the coup took place against President Chavez. There were between 50 and 60 people who were gunned down, at least, in the streets. The Cuban embassy was attacked by opposition supporters, and that included by Enrique Capriles, as well as Leopoldo López, who, if people remember, Enrique Capriles was a presidential candidate several years back against both Chavez and Maduro in 2012 and 2013 and lost. Leopoldo López is the former mayor of Chacao, who was found guilty of instigating violence, the Guarimba violence that took place, part of La Salida, or the exit, in the years of 2013 and 2014. And so we've seen, you know, all these different people involved, not just now, but before. Julio Borges, who was the National Assembly president prior to Juan Guaido, who's been implicated in the assassination attempt of President Nicolas Maduro that took place in August of 2018. You know, so we have to look at this moment within a trajectory, within step sequences of aggression. These are not isolated incidents. These are moments that are really at the root of it, trying to create societal chaos, create scenarios for justification for the United States to intervene, and really fundamentally trying to gain power over not only a people, but resources and internationally.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also reminded of the sort of language that the Western media is using, right? That people are starving and that there's no medicine coming in and out and there's just there's no toilet paper. I mean, some of the claims get more and more and more bizarre to the point where they claim that people are breaking into zoos and eating the exotic animals in zoos, right? And these sort of outlandish claims that happen to be told every time a socialist country is under attack. They say the same thing about Cuba. They've said the same thing about other countries. But one, any mention whatsoever of the financial or living situation in Venezuela on mainstream media, it's never accompanied by the sort of role the opposition has had in that, or the role that U.S. sanctions have had in that. And mm-hmm. for a sort of a third, you know, addition to that, they never mention what the government has done to alleviate poverty and the sort of social programs they've implemented. So we get this language and this coding that's void of any context on almost any side. Can you speak a little bit about that? Maybe like the role of the opposition in the chaos? Because you mentioned chaos, and I think they are very determined to stir dissent.
Of course, as you mentioned, I mean, just to kind of hit some main points there, all the discourse, the narrative, the language that's anti-Maduro, anti-Bolivarian socialism, anti-Chavista, you know, anti-Venezuelan in many ways is, you know, claiming that this entire country is undemocratic, is backwards, people don't know how to govern themselves. And fundamentally that's white supremacist and it's racist. We've seen it in the case of, you know, the U.S., Canadian, and French-backed coup in Haiti. We've seen it in different cases across the African continent and, like, socialist processes that took place. You know, the United States is going in as a purveyor, allegedly, of democracy and of sustainability and of governance. And for those of us who live in the United States, we know that that's not true, but that's a huge historical farce. But it's one of the ways and means in which the United States, through political opposition in Venezuela, have been able to justify these attacks. Many of the political cartoons against Maduro and even against Chavez in his time were, you know, comparing Chavez to a gorilla, comparing Maduro to a donkey. So all these different things have really heightened racist undertones and classist undertones as well. The right-wing radical fringes of the political opposition in Venezuela are the vast majority are people who are coming from slave-owning elites, from corporate families, from oil families, from people who are used to their high-level positions of power, their oligarchy status within the country, European descendants, people who meet with the likes of President Donald Trump, Vice President Pence, you know, who are shaking the hands essentially with people who sanction murder and genocide all around the world. So, you know, I think that's one piece. The impact of sanctions and now what is essentially a blockade on the oil company PDVSA are huge. The impacts have, in the last several years, radically shifted what is accessible in the country and also the state's efficiency economically. And the state has made many attempts to try and remedy the impacts of the sanctions and grassroots movements as well, such as the communes, campesinos and campesinas, such as farmers, Afro-Venezuelan communities, indigenous nations, feminist networks, eco-socialists are also trying to remedy the impacts of the blockade through different initiatives, such as bartering networks, such as, you know, more agricultural development across the country, such as community and shared systems of production and things like that. But, you know, I want to just mention, like, the actual numerical, the quantitative impacts, right? So Jorge Arreaza, the Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs in Venezuela, during his interview with Amy Goodman at Democracy Now!, mentioned that the sanctions have cost, according to government figures, at least $23 billion. In the last several years. Now, with the new statement that was issued from the Treasury Department at the end of January, all PDVSA assets that are under U.S. jurisdiction are blocked. And that took effect immediately once Trump signed that statement. And it prohibits all U.S. citizens and companies from engaging in any transactions with PDVSA. And also, all of these assets will be tools to support Juan Guaido. And that was by the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, who recognized, you know, the United States has recognized Juan Guaido as the official president of Venezuela, even though he was not constitutionally elected by the Venezuelan people. So cumulatively, this is estimated that Venezuela will lose approximately $11 billion in exports in 2019 alone, and that $7 billion in assets have already been frozen.
I was just going to say there's also the specific case of the U.S. informing the National Bank of England not to return the gold reserves of, I believe, what was it, $1.3 billion to Venezuela. So the U.K. is quite literally stealing gold assets and refusing, and they're trying to find loopholes in order to reroute those assets to Guaido and the opposition.
Exactly. And that's the one big piece, right, is it's not just the theft of Venezuelan gold, the theft of Venezuelan oil revenue, but that the United States, because it dominates all these economic and financial institutions and coerces other states and governments, is now going to illegally transfer what is property of the Venezuelan people to an illegitimate interim president, Juan Guaido, and whomever he dictates is in his government. You know, he's been appointing people as illegitimate ambassadors to different countries all throughout the world, you know, within the 30 plus countries that have recognized him as the official president of Venezuela. And so what we're seeing, too, is an entire break from international agreements and diplomatic agreements around the world, which is which should not be taken lightly, to say the least. Like, that is very significant that this is taking place. And actually, during the 2004 coup against Aristide and the Haitian people, this is something that was very similar as well, is this entire kind of disregard for diplomatic agreements, recognition of illegitimate officials. And in Venezuela, we're seeing a very similar playbook.
Definitely. I mean, the sort of propaganda campaign that's going on right now by the opposition is really extensive. Just last night here in Washington, D.C., I watched as journalist Max Blumenthal debated a member of the opposition. I don't know how to word it. I guess a member of the party or whatever, Francisco Marquez, who had just the night before met with the Atlantic Council, who is, of course, NATO and regime change funded, right? So it's very extensive. And I think the background on the assets that are being sort of rerouted to those people, or at least attempted to and stolen, is really important. It's a crucial part that people are really missing.
Exactly.
So, and I want to ask you, because, I mean, these are all, and I want my listeners to understand, these are all processes of regime change that are 101 in the U.S. playbook, whether it be Haiti or Grenada. Mm-hmm. We could keep on going on. The list goes on and on. Panama, right? This is the precedent. This isn't an anomaly or a hiccup. This is actually U.S. foreign policy working how it's meant to work.
Exactly.
So with that said... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and in a moment where globally, I would say working people and generally the poor at large are clear that capitalism does not work, mm-hmm. that capitalism hasn't worked historically, that as a consequence of colonialism, that this system has oppressed us for far too long, and that Venezuela, it really stands as an example of a process that is trying to build socialism, that is trying to build another economic and political and cultural model, and really that's what's also, you know, being targeted. One of the things that I forgot to mention that I think might be of incredible interest to the folks that are listening, because I know you've done programs on Black and Palestinian solidarity, is that recently on February 2nd, there were national mobilizations as well, mm-hmm. you know, massive mobilizations amongst the Chavista forces, and also, you know, protests and mobilizations across opposition kind of strongholds. And at the opposition marches, they had the flags that, you know, of different countries that had represented, recognized Juan Guaido. And the two most prominent flags that were featured big screen were the United States flag and the Israeli flag. And so that goes to show us who the opposition is aligned with, who is also funding, supporting, and really banking literally on this regime change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. There's even videos that you can watch online of the opposition leaders taking down Venezuelan flags and placing U.S. flags up where they were. I mean, it's bizarrely obvious to anyone who's just paying the slightest attention. So with that, I mean, my next question was going to be sort of, you've done this in a roundabout way, but in a more sort of direct way. Can you tell me who Guaido is and who the opposition are, I guess, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I want to go to a sort of more grassroots perspective of everything that's happening mm-hmm. right now. But I guess that's my mm-hmm. last question before we turn to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I mentioned before, some of the names that are the most prominent in the Venezuelan opposition include Enrique Capriles, Leopoldo López, Julio Borges, all of these folks who come from a very elite background in Venezuela. Many trained and have studied in the United States, have been funded by entities such as USAID. Juan Guaido is, you know, a 35-year-old head of the National Assembly, went to George Washington State with clear ties to the United States. You know, and really, I try not to emphasize too much on these particular characters because really they're part of a historical parade of colonial administrators. They are, you know, people who have essentially betrayed or actually people who have aligned with their global interests as part of an elite. You know, in Venezuela, one of the things that has happened over the course of the last 20 years is a renewed sense of nationalism. You know, is a renewed sense of nationalism that is really rooted in, you know, Venezuela's plurality as an African descendant nation, as an indigenous nation, as a majority youth nation. And Venezuelans, by far and large, oppose intervention across the political spectrum. You know, people understand that, you know, military intervention is not going to result in peace for Venezuela and Venezuelans, nor will it result in peace for anywhere in Latin America and the Caribbean for many years to come if it occurs. And, you know, I want to make a clear tie that, you know, many people in this opposition, Maria Corina Machado and others, you know, have actively pleaded with the United States to intervene, you know, have, you know, advocated for either humanitarian intervention, which is essentially a disguise for military intervention, because it's not that, you know, human rights workers or social workers or farmers are bringing in humanitarian aid. That's legitimate humanitarian aid. And Venezuela does not need or want humanitarian aid. But it's actually, you know, boots on the ground, military officials, you know, whether it be the United Nations or whether it be the U.S. or whether it be Colombian or whether it be Brazilian army. You know, these are threats against Venezuelan sovereignty. And so that's something I want to emphasize, is because the vast majority of people in Venezuela, over 80% of the country, is in opposition to U.S. intervention. And actually, as we speak right now, this week, the country is starting to a signature campaign and they're going to take signatures from all across the country and send them to Washington, to the White House, to prove that the Venezuelan people oppose sanctions, oppose intervention, and oppose regime change.
Mm-hmm. And I was watching earlier, there were videos of people in Caracas lining up very long lines across the city, yes, to sign their names on those petitions.
And exactly.
It just shows the power of it. Well, you mentioned sort of Afro-Venezuelanos and women, of course. And I want to sort of get a grassroots perspective. And I know there's been massive, huge, like, protests. Some people are saying up towards the millions, but certainly thousands of Venezuelans who have came to protest in support of Maduro that the media, of course, is not showing. Can you speak a little bit about, I guess not, you know, fully, because we're going to do another episode or another interview specifically on the topic of what the revolution means for Black people. But just in brief, can you speak to sort of what this moment and what this revolution and what Maduro and the Bolivarian revolution means for the Black people in Venezuela, as well as sort of women and the youth and poor people and, mm-hmm, and the grassroots perspective of everything?
Of course. I mean, you know, one of the pivotal moments that really, you know, builds the foundation of the Bolivarian process is the 1999 constitution and the referendum and the fact that this constitution was written by the people and approved by the people. Venezuelans across the country know their constitution from the first page to the very last page. People can quote articles. People carry their constitution in their purses, in their backpacks, in their pockets. And really, it's been a source of political empowerment because this constitution is one that's principled in human rights, that really outlines, you know, outlines humanity and really emphasizes different sectors of society, includes land reform, includes indigenous rights, includes women's rights. And, you know, right now Venezuelans are in a process to rewrite their constitution under the National Constituent Assembly. And other countries all across Latin America and the Caribbean, including Bolivia, Cuba, Nicaragua, all these nations that have gone through revolutionary processes have used the Constitution as a means to transforming society. by and through and for the people. So I think that's first and foremost incredibly important, because for Afro-Venezuelans in particular, the Constitution has meant recognition of a nation of people, right, that historically have been, you know, marginalized to the side of history in Venezuela. And now we're at the forefront of national histories, of official histories. You know, Venezuelans, when they talk about the Bolivarian process, go back, you know, to the namesake, Simón Bolívar, but then also as a liberator, as a liberator of South America, but then also go to the histories of the Haitian Revolution, because the Haitian Revolution was so critical to Venezuelan and South American independence. Without the support of Haitian revolutionaries and essentially just African peoples all throughout the Caribbean, but namely in Haiti, Hugo Chavez said, you know, we would not be as a nation where we are were it not for Haiti. And therefore, we have a historical debt to Haiti and also to you know, the African continent. You know, one of... before I go into kind of more of the popular piece, one of the last documents that Hugo Chavez wrote was a letter to the third summit of Africa and South America, where he essentially outlines and recognizes and talks about the shared history between Latin America and the Caribbean and the African continent. He talks about the richness of resources, the fact that, you know, he says here, and I'm going to quote a little bit, he says, "And our continents is where we find enough natural resources, political resources, and historical resources that are required to save the planet from the chaos that it has been experiencing. We cannot lose the opportunity of achieving this independence that our ancestors have left for us to do and to carry out today." And, you know, he talks about how important it is for not only solidarity, but integration, cooperation, respect. And those are principles that from the state level to the grassroots are what people hold dear to them in their work day to day, in the institutions, in education, in healthcare, and community councils. You know, Venezuelans were organizing before the Bolivarian process, before Bolivarian Revolution, you know, which we often mark at like 1999. But many of those structures, many of those community ties continued. And Afro-Venezuelans have been at the forefront of that, whether it be, you know, with José Leonardo Chirino, who is, you know, remembered as an African and indigenous Maroon leader in Venezuela who led a rebellion in Coro in 1795, to people such as Argelia Laya, who in the 20th century led a guerrilla formation and was a communist in the mountains of Lara and was Afro-Venezuelan and one of the first women to really talk about feminism from the left, you know, from radical visions, from Black perspectives. You know, we see the work that Venezuela has done to provide just basic human resources and rights, such as housing. You know, one thing that's not talked about, you know, in the international media, as they claim that Venezuela is in this self-induced crisis, allegedly, is that, you know, Venezuela in the last 5 to 6 years has built 2.5 million homes, essentially making it the world's greatest housing developer. You know, and these are homes that are destined for the working class and the poor, people who've been displaced by natural disasters, you know, such as what happened in 2011 with huge torrential rainstorms. You know, and in the United States, we've seen the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf Coast. We've seen the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. In Haiti, we've seen the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake. And in none of those scenarios have we seen an actual, you know, approach to supporting the people to recover, to reclaim lands, to, you know, to the right to stay. You know, and so I think that's critically important that in Venezuela, people, you know, I was talking to a friend this morning, and he's Afro-Venezuelan. He lives in 23 de Enero, the 23rd of January. It's a neighborhood in Caracas, one of the most radical sites of Chavismo in Caracas. And, you know, he makes chocolates. You know, cacao is a very big crop in Venezuela. Historically, was, you know, the plantation societies across the Caribbean coastline were of cacao. And so it's only until recently that cacao has been nationalized, you know, where people now are both artisanally and through socialist enterprises producing chocolates. And he said, you know, I want to stay in my country and I plan on staying in Venezuela because I believe in what we're doing. He's like, and I believe that we as a people need to generate our economies. We need to build a socialist economy. You know, and so those are the narratives from the people that I think are critically important to hear right now. Folks in Venezuela are continuing to organize. They're doing incredible things, building huge communes, you know, of thousands of people who are committed to agricultural production, to textiles, to, you know, to really providing for each other, for caring about one another, you know, the grouping of dozens of communities in any given territory. And there are thousands of communes all throughout Venezuela. You know, campesinos have marched in Venezuela over the last 6 months, you know, demanding greater land reforms because they're like, we need to push the revolutionary envelope, marching miles, hundreds of miles from across the country to the capital. You know, there have been incredible, I think, just revolutionary steps that are being taken, you know, from feminist groups. You know, people have written a law. It's called the Humanizing Birth Law. And it recognizes, you know, one of the early laws in the Bolivarian process recognized the 16 forms of violence against women. And the Humanizing Birthing Law talks about how to humanize the birthing process, how to ensure that violence does not occur towards women or families or children during the birthing process, which, you know, is often not talked about in different parts of the world. I mean, in the United States, we have such high rates of morbidity and mortality rates amongst both women and people who've given birth post, during labor and after labor, and then also of children, and particularly amongst Black people who have the highest rates. So in a place like Venezuela, that's a priority, like how to prevent, you know, how to prevent death, essentially, how to put forth a life with happiness. You know, and I think those are the conversations that really need to be in the headlines, because those are the conversations that are going to propel our movements forward, that are going to inform our strategy on the left and in social movements in the United States, and are really going to help orient us when our revolutionary process comes to fruition.
I mean, I 100% agree, and I couldn't have said it better myself. And I mean, I hope that, you know, this conversation is one that others are at least trying to have. And I hope that this platform, you know, people can listen to it and then go and find other conversations and do their own research. I mean, honestly, even getting sort of through the propaganda and the bias is not even that hard, because the Venezuelan revolution has been such a magnificently impactful one to the whole world of Latin America, Africa, and the Caribbean specifically. So there's a whole host of work out there that shows its significance and its power. And of course, what's happening right now is in the vein of U.S. intervention and imperialism across Latin America, in the same way that Walter Rodney was writing about the intervention and imperialism across Africa, right? And it's an extraction of resources, it's a domination, it's an exploitation, and it's capitalism at its highest stage within imperialism and neocolonialism. So with that, I think we're sort of out on time, but we've covered a lot of bases in a short amount of time, and you're such an incredible resource to speak with on this topic. Well, coming up, we have, of course, your interview that just happened, and then I'll be talking with Dan Kovalik, who is a human rights lawyer. He's also written a book called How the U.S. Spent Billions of Dollars to Rig Elections Around the World, and it's going to talk about he's going to sort of explain his own experience being one of the official election observers in Venezuela, and how the propaganda surrounding elections is completely false and fabricated. And a lot of it is just as wild as it may seem when you hear people talk about it from the U.S. side. I mean,
And can I just say, I am so excited for that interview, because there were hundreds of people observing these last presidential elections. We had a delegation, and we met with folks from South Africa, from Korea, from Brazil, from Guatemala, from Europe, from the United States. There were people from everywhere who observed these elections, from grassroots organizations to electoral institutions to you know, regional bodies such as like the African Union. So there's really no way that the Constitution was violated.
We're going to get into the discussion a little bit about how the opposition actually boycotted the last election And now they're trying to use that in their favor. But we'll get into that a little bit. And then I'm going to speak with Christina Schiavone. I might be pronouncing her last name wrong. She'll correct me for that. And she's going to talk about what the revolution meant for agricultural workers and rural farmers, peasants, aka landless people. She's going to talk about what the revolution meant for them and how Venezuela has been working towards food sovereignty and how wonderful it's doing at this task. And then, Jeanette, you have an interview as well, right?
Yes. And then I'll be interviewing Akinyele Umoja, who is one of the co-founders of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, who also has written work about the history of Black militant organizing in the South, particularly in Mississippi, who's a professor, a great historian, and in the last several years has been visiting Venezuela and really building with Afro-Venezuelans, has also been doing a lot of work around the question of reparations. You know, we met at the first International Reparations Summit in Venezuela, and it was a spectacular, really important, momentous gathering with just bringing together people from all across the Americas, African continent, to talk about how do we demand collectively for reparations, and not just limit ourselves to financial restitution, which is incredibly important and must happen. But what are the cultural, political, spiritual, and social and other dimensions? So we'll be talking about that and other things regarding Afro-Venezuelans.
All right. And with that, this has been another episode of the Groundings podcast in collaboration with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Thank you so much for your time, Jeanette. And I can't wait to wrap it all up.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited.
All right. Well, I'm Devin Springer here, host of the Groundings podcast, and I have with me today Dan Kovalik. I'm a big fan of his, and I have followed him on social media as well as seen him on the news many times as a guest on different channels. He's a human rights lawyer, was also an official observer for the elections in Venezuela as well as other countries, and he recently wrote the books The Plot to Scapegoat Russia and The Plot to Attack Iran, among other books. I'm actually going to let Dan go ahead and introduce himself. So, Dan?
Yeah, so you got it right, and I also teach international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. And I do have a brand new book out, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change Election Results Throughout the World, and encourage people to pick it up.
Yeah, and that book is actually sort of, I guess, a perfect framing for our conversation today. As we know, and as the listeners of this podcast, I hope, know after listening to the first part of this episode, there's a sort of global aggression taking place against Venezuela and Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution. And one of the number one lines that the Western and corporate media has been using is sort of discussion about elections. Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, has declared himself interim president. And previously, the opposition has stated that the elections which put Maduro in power were a quote-unquote sham election. Before we sort of dive into the details, Dan, can I get your overview of this and your sort of general take on this?
Yes, well, I was actually an election observer in May in Caracas for the re-election of Nicolas Maduro. And I can say with certainty that it was not a sham election. Here are the facts about it. He ran against an opposition candidate named Henry Falcone from the business community, a legitimate opposition candidate who had his own vision of Venezuela. Before the election, Donald Trump threatened Henry Falcone with sanctions if he even ran against Maduro. And why? Because the Trump administration wanted to totally delegitimize the Venezuelan elections. Falcone resisted Trump's threats, and he ran against Maduro. Now, meanwhile, other elements of the opposition called for an abstention from the election, urge their people not to vote. And it was very interesting. I went to different polling places. In the more working class and poor areas, there was very brisk voter turnout. In the wealthier areas, there was very low voter turnout, meaning that in the wealthier areas, they honored the call for an abstention, which, of course, people are, they're entitled to do. Ultimately, 46% of the electorate came out to vote, which, isn't great, but it compares, fairly equally with voter turnout in the U.S. And of those who voted, 67% voted for Nicolas Maduro, meaning nearly 6 million people voted for him. This idea that it was a sham election is just pure propaganda. No one really disputes the fact that he got these votes of almost 6 million people and that he got, 67% of those who voted to vote for him. There's nothing illegitimate about that. And so I think that is a big lie that's being promoted here.
So one of the things I want you to sort of break down to your best ability for our listeners is, one, what it means to be a sort of observer of an election or an electoral process. And I know there were hundreds, probably thousands of observers from around the world who came. I mean, the African Union, for example, sent dozens of official observers and statesmen, as well as other regional groups. So, one, what goes into that observing process? And then two, what the actual voting process in Venezuela is like? Because just a few years ago, Forbes magazine was putting out articles saying that it could actually be an example for the rest of the world. And now, it feels like, of course, they've done a 180 with most of the liberal media. So can you sort of talk about those two things?
Yeah. And also Jimmy Carter, by the way, said it was the best electoral system in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it is very impressive. So first of all, when you're an election observer there, you're free to go anywhere you want, to talk to anyone you want, to see people vote, to see the vote count on the ground when it happens, to go to the CNE headquarters at the end of the night to see their vote tally, to even go to the voter, the center where the voting machines are made and where the voting ballots are held. You get to see the election in action in a way, frankly, that you would never be allowed to see in the U.S., right? We would never allow, especially international observers, to look under the skirt of the U.S. electoral system in this way. And how does the electoral system in Venezuela work? First of all, unlike the U.S., where every state can determine, the mechanics of their voting, for example, in 2000, Florida had its hanging Chad problem, you might remember, which was a unique problem. Why? No one else used the system they used. Every state can do what they want in this country within certain limits. In Venezuela, after Chavez was elected in 1999, they now have a very uniform and very reliable system for voting. And how it works is, you go to a voting center, you must present your fingerprint and place it on a machine that reads your fingerprint. You must show a voter ID. And if you don't do that, the machine won't even turn on for you to vote. And Republicans should love this. They love all this voter ID stuff. But in any case, what that does is it, one, makes it apparent that you have the right to vote, and two, it prevents you from voting twice. So you do that, and then you move to once that happens and the machine goes on, you move from the table where you show your ID, present your fingerprint, you move to the actual voting area where you have an electronic voting machine and you cast a secret ballot by electronic vote. And then when you're done with that, the electronic machine prints out a paper receipt showing how you voted. You then move again. It's a horseshoe, by the way. It's a horseshoe shape you vote in. You then move over to a box where you place that paper ballot. And by the end of the night, 55% of the boxes or of the voting, you know, places are audited to see that the paper ballots match up with the electronic results. So it's a very elegant process, which is very hard to beat in terms of fraud or multiple voting. So no one really can claim credibly that the votes cast weren't appropriate. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it hard for people to say it was a sham election, and yet it doesn't stop them from doing so, apparently.
Right. And I think, I mean, it sounds like it's sophisticated, embarrassingly so, beyond a point that the U.S. is even close to being at. And there's sort of a certain hypocrisy that anyone in the U.S. where not only do we have millions of incarcerated people who can't vote, but we also have massive voter suppression in states like Georgia, Florida, Kentucky, pretty much all 50 states. Now, in your book, The Plot to Control the World, which sort of discusses how the U.S. rigs and elections and meddles in elections across the world, you deal very specifically with this topic that we're discussing right now as it relates to Venezuela. Do you see this same sorts of, rhetoric that's being used around Venezuela, and not just their elections, but their constitution, and like this sort of attempt to use legality as a way to promote regime change? In your book and your research, have you seen sort of similar things being used elsewhere?
Yeah, well, it's a misuse of legality. You know, it's claiming that countries like Venezuela are not abiding by international standards of democracy and elections, when in fact they are, and when, as you note, the U.S. itself is not. You know, there's a huge irony that Donald Trump, who's president by virtue of the fact that he got 3 million votes less than Hillary Clinton. You know, let's keep that in mind. He lost the election in terms of vote count, right? But we have this bizarre electoral college system, which most people would think is outdated and not democratic. So here's a guy who lost the election by vote count, who's president, who's criticizing Nicolas Maduro, who got 67% of the votes cast. There's just an incredible hypocrisy here and tone deafness about reality and about who is abiding by international law. But certainly, as you know, essentially the U.S. turns international law on its head to try to force regime change.
Mm-hmm. And why, this is a big question and probably has a simple answer in my opinion, but why do you think that the U.S. is so, so adamant in this regime change, and why they're trying to make this sort of this new fight in the same way that we had sort of blank terrorist rhetoric for several years, if that makes sense?
Well, I think there's a couple big reasons. So one, we know from John Bolton, the national security advisor, that oil's a huge reason. I mean, he was very open about the fact that he wants American companies to have an interest in Venezuelan oil, which at the moment is owned by the Venezuelan people and used for their benefit. So that's a very open secret. And the other issue is that we do not abide by countries, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, that have decided to go their own independent path of economic and political development. And Venezuela is the key country which in 1999, with Chavez's inauguration, really began an independence movement throughout Latin America, which is known as the Pink Tide. And that has been slowly rolled back over time. And now the U.S. wants to crush the font of that Pink Tide, which is Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost the fear of a good example, you know, is another sort of big reason in this turning tide. Another question that comes to mind, we know that there's a huge movement right now of activists across the world and within Venezuela calling for the removal of sanctions against Venezuela. In What's interesting is I was recently watching a video where Max Blumenthal, who's a journalist here in the U.S., he went to several members of Congress asking them how they felt about the sanctions against Venezuela if they support them. And several of the Democrats said, "We hope they hurt the top officials before they hurt the people," which is essentially absurd, right? So have the effects of the sanctions, I guess, to what extent have they affected the people, and what is the response like to end those sanctions?
Yes, well, they have hurt the people quite a bit. In fact, the former UN expert Alfred de Zayas, who's been speaking out about this, and he went to Venezuela to investigate the effect of the sanctions, has been very clear that it's the sanctions that are the primary cause of the economic problems in Venezuela, of deprivation in Venezuela. The U.S. has essentially crippled Venezuela's economy. Last year alone, the U.S.'s sanctions cost Venezuela $20 billion. And that's a lot of money for Venezuela. And you know, that's money that would be used for health care and food. Meanwhile, Venezuela still spends over 70% of its revenue on social services, which is incredible. But the U.S. is denying them revenue through these sanctions. And that is what's hurting everyday ordinary people. And that's the point of the sanctions. It's to extort the Venezuelan people, to extort them into rising up against their government. That's what sanctions are always about. It's never about hurting the government or government officials. It's about hurting the people who support the government and essentially holding them hostage until they say, you know, cry uncle and overthrow their government.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that what's happening right now in Venezuela sort of falls in line with U.S. foreign policy across all of Latin America and the Caribbean, this sort of holding people hostage and funding right-wing coups and quote-unquote oppositions until they get what they want?
Absolutely, and not just in Latin America, throughout the world. I mean, the U.S. has sanctions imposed against about 35 countries in the world. And all of the sanctions are you know, the purpose of them is to put these countries in line with U.S. economic and political hegemony. This is against international law, but this is what the U.S. does. And yes, in Latin America in particular, the U.S. has and continues to partner with right-wing regimes in Latin America to try to prevent democracy and popular governments from succeeding.
Mm-hmm. And luckily, the response this time in the situation of Venezuela has been overwhelming support from fellow countries in Latin America, across Africa and Asia and in the Caribbean as well, as well as workers here in the U.S. who are standing up and saying the U.S. needs to get out of Venezuela as well as everywhere else, right? So I guess my last question to you is a two-part question. Is one, sort of the global response we've seen to the propaganda war that's being waged on Venezuela feels positive. It feels as if the global workers, activists, organizers, citizens around the world are upset by this in a way that the U.S. might not have predicted. So I want to get sort of your take on what you make of the response. And then two, if you have any message for people and how and what we can do and how we can get involved, of course, in continuing some kind of campaign of helping the Venezuelan people maintain their sovereignty.
Yes, well, I think, you know, there have certainly been very positive reactions to this attempt to overthrow the Maduro government. I think there are a lot of groups in the U.S. and throughout the world that are opposing this, and I think that that could make all the difference to Venezuela. And I think people need to put pressure on their Congress people and on their government to respect Venezuela, to respect its electoral processes, and, you know, to stop U.S. intervention in Venezuela, either by economic warfare or by military warfare. So the only people who can stop this intervention, in fact, are U.S. citizens, because we still have a at least ostensibly democratic country, and we're the ones that need to speak out against this intervention. And I encourage people to travel to Venezuela to see for themselves that country, to see that it has a lot to offer, to see their government is doing a lot for their own people, and to come back to the U.S. and tell people about it. It's very important.
Yeah, I certainly agree with everything you've said here tonight. And with that, I think that concludes our interview. So this has been part of a special groundings report on Venezuela, current and historical. Thank you, Dan, for your time.
Thanks, Devin. I really appreciate it.